May 11th, 1949, philosophy 10.
Selves. To the impact of the new sciences. In this preparatory period, they close themselves to the impact of the new sciences. The universities, which are called universities. Academy and university from 1500 to 1600 are in conflict. Academy and university from 1500 to 1600 are in conflict. Universities at that time are places for teaching. Academies don't teach. They are groups of adults. Either in literature or in research. To this day, the term academy in Europe does not imply teaching. Example. Paracelsus lives from 1493 to 1541. Is expelled from the university and lives as a migratory explorer for another 15 years. That's the example, gentlemen. See, his life is so great because in the life of the greatest man, the life itself is law. That is, if you read Newman's life, as one of you told me, you have learned the Ten Commandments of education out of Newman's life. Of course I have. The life of Jesus is standard of life. The life of the church is a standard for political development. The life of Newman is itself a fountain of teaching us. We can't sit in judgment over our life really lived. The empirical life is much more demonstrative than what we think about life. Now the same is true in Paracelsus' case, gentlemen. 15 years of errancy. Of waiting after his death. His works published in 1586. In 1610 he entered the university. How was it done? It's a tremendous story of tragedy and suffering. 40 years of faithful waiting of his friends and searching for his manuscripts went by until the great edition of his works appeared in 1586. And then he only existed. People couldn't read what he had printed. You see, it was all scattered, or it was suppressed. You have to read this in my pamphlet how he was treated. In 1610, he entered the universities in the person of Van Helmont.
So, to this day, the textbooks give the honor to Helmont, which is due to Paracelsus. Van Helmont is the first professor to quote Paracelsus from the chair. Van Helmont, L-H-E-L-M-O-N-T. And he's the first
to decline the oath on the books of Galenus, the old classical doctor. He's the first to decline to take the oath. In other words, he's the first who shakes off the medieval yoke of authority in medicine as against experience. Now, you see how you take an oath on the Constitution any day, it is ask you whether you are willing to observe it or not in the state of, in D.C., in this District of Columbia, the Congress has passed a very foul law. An employee of the federal government is there required to take an oath on the Constitution every first of the month when he draws a salary. Now that's just inviting perjury. And it's, of course, there's nothing more blasphemous than to ask a man to take an oath whenever he, a lawyer, he oaths to the Constitution of the United States every month. Not childish, gentlemen, but childishness in serious affairs begets, of course, destruction. It's one of these nihilistic moods in which the country finds itself, you see. If you start shooting with heavy guns at mosquitoes, you see, you get atomic warfare. There's very little left of the spirit of a country. And this law of the Congress is one of the most pernicious, nefarious measures was passed during the war, as a matter of fact. An employee of the federal government has to take an oath every month. And nobody protests. These employees do it. This is a shameful thing in their field. It took the doctors of all Europe so long, gentlemen, to say in 1610, in the person of one single heroic man, no, this oath of a doctor of the Middle Ages that I will read the books of Galenus, you see, shall not bind me. The simplest things, you see, gentlemen, are very often delayed beyond belief. Paracelsus was the first professor to teach German, and it cost him his office. Helmont, his grandson, so to speak, was the first man to decline the oath, and they had to accept him as a professor just to say. They did. He broke the precedent. That's 1610. That's the fulfillment of Paracelsus' postulate. That experience comes before classical tradition. Research before literature. Yes, before letters. That's new. Can you see the reversal of the order, you see? Before letters came before research, you see. And with Helmont, the university accepted this, and he is therefore Paracelsus entering the university. Now you see, it's 120 years. Gentlemen, 120 years is an important period. It's always four generations, four times 30 years. Each time you find that after 120 years a new great start is made in the humans by the human soul. You get the French Revolution, 1789, and you get the World War, 1914. 120 years. 120 years through all of history is an important period. In 120 years, the memory of one state of affairs goes, and people are then ready to give it a new start. The story of Paracelsus is a tremendous story because the early death of a man, he dies in his 48th year because he uses mercury in his experiments, and obviously that had killed him. You see, nobody on lead. Something of this kind of poisoning must have happened to him. And so he dies. The curve of his life, gentlemen, goes on just untouched. If he had lived to 90 as Cardinal Newman, they might have crowned him, you see. Then he dies at 48. That doesn't mean that the start of his beginning hasn't to be pursued. The works appear not before and not later, but 1586. You see? And that's by and large 90 years, you see, the same way in which, so to speak, Newman reached his performance. You cannot alter the workings of the spirit. That's a very lawful order. whether a man dies young or a man dies old, gentlemen, if he is in the grace of God, the efficiency of the fruit of his work takes the same amount of seed and growth and tillage and weeding and harvest in one case or the other. And if you know this, gentlemen, your peace of mind may grow. That's why a soldier who dies in battle has not died in vain. You won't believe it, gentlemen, but this is much truer than your own lives, which are wasted so often. If you don't invest by an act of faith in the history of your country, you will not bear fruit if you become 150 years old. But a soldier who dies for a good cause, he will bear fruit after 30 years, after 50 years, because there's a real action. This you can learn from this life of Paracelsus, gentlemen. He dies in exile, persecuted, forgotten. Nobody even knows what he has written because he couldn't print it. You see, was all hidden and persecuted. In 1541, he has just disappeared. And in 1586, he is back. And in 1610, he is there, in the place of his, which had expelled him, in the university. From 1610, gentlemen, to 1780, the universities get ready to embrace research. And, by 1800, the universities establish their first laboratories. In the laboratory, the academy and the university are reconciled. You can see this. The academy did not begin with laboratory, but with correspondence of travelers. In the laboratory, you have a compromise, a local place that experiments, you see, and research going on. So it's a very wonderful story, gentlemen. Till 1600, complete enmity between the teaching school and the place of research and correspondence. Can you see this now? Somebody asked about the relation of academies and universities, and you were doubtful here. Wasn't this you? Who asked? Somebody here. Well, you see it now. University and academy have nothing to do till 1600. Then Mr. Hellemont comes, and the university listens to research, but doesn't do any research itself. They don't organize it. In 1800, the universities begin to appropriate laboratories. The colleges only follow at the end of the 19th century. Dartmouth College had a so-called philosophical apparatus instead of a laboratory, down to 1890. President Tucker was the first man to build a laboratory in this college. Now you think a college consists of laboratories. That's only 50 years old. 50 years old, 50 years is nothing in the history of the mind. That's a very short story. It's very belated, gentlemen, that the American college has laboratories. The university has it 100 years longer. The academy has it 100 years before again, you see. And before the founders had their little workshops, you see. The academies didn't have it. So, gentlemen, you can put it this way. Paracelsus has a laboratory. The Royal Society has a laboratory, which was founded in 1665 only, you see. After 1800, universities have laboratories. And after 1900, colleges and prep schools get laboratories. So the laboratory goes from founder, you see, to scientific institution, to university, and finally down to commonplace. And today, every man has a bedroom and a laboratory in his own home. So you have in the form of the modern research room, what we call laboratory, you see, you have again the history from idea to commonplace. First phase, one man dares to have a laboratory. Second phase, scientific institutions of research have laboratories. Third phase, universities have laboratories, you see, educational institutions. And fourth phase, everybody has can have a laboratory. See it? Now let's stop here in the survey of the academies in their growth. The next chapter, gentlemen, deals with the means by which the sciences are developed in the Middle Ages and in modern times. Now perhaps let me make one remark as an appendix to the academic survey. The next form of research will be neither laboratory nor the chapel of the Middle Ages, or where the monks meet and concord and make peace. It will probably be camps. We today are preparing the next form of research in the social sciences that will be not done in laboratory. If you have today sociological laboratories, that's a confusion of methods. That's an attempt to investigate society with natural methods. You can't do that. The camping institutions, camps of all kinds, work camps, service camps, exploration camps, are places where you can study human nature. I only hint at this to show you that the academies and the laboratories are certainly not the last form of scientific development. Each period, gentlemen, the theological period, the academic period, and the future social period, will have their own means. Now comes the second, this next chapter. In the Middle Ages, concording is a higher form of logic. And on logic and concording, the whole order of thought is proceeding. The process of the Middle Ages is logic on the lower level and concording on the higher level. Concording is done where two logical arguments clash. We said, concording is done where two minds think differently, but in unity of heart overcome their discord. The method of the Middle Ages, gentlemen, then is a higher logic, which today is completely forgotten. You always talk of logic, but the Middle Ages knew already that mere logic is nonsense, valueless, it's for children. Syllogisms. You can't prove anything in between real people by mere logic. Nobody believes you. You know everybody rationalizes. Logic is a harlot, says out to anybody. But higher logic, gentlemen, is the medieval principle of dialectical concording. In contrast, the academic progress moves on two levels of arithmetic and geometry at the lower level and higher mathematics on the upper. Higher mathematics is algebra and calculus. The difference between geometry and arithmetic and higher mathematics is the introduction of the term infinity and zero. Mere arithmetic doesn't know what -3 is. It doesn't know what an imaginary figure is. It doesn't know what infinity is. The multiplication table knows nothing. There is in mathematics a distinct necessity for you to distinguish between higher mathematics and simple arithmetic. These are two words. Higher mathematics didn't exist in Europe before 1500. Higher mathematics is the creation of the last 400 years. That's always forgotten by you. There didn't exist this higher mathematics. And higher mathematics depends on the introduction of zero and infinity as new determinants for the proceedings, you see. You can be today count down from zero, as you know, with minus, you see, as much as we count up. They couldn't do this before 1500. They didn't, at least. And then we have the infinity, which allows us calculus, which is called the computation of infinitesimal small things, you see. Infinitesimal means, you see, to recognize the concept of infinity. The future, gentlemen, will also have two sciences. Grammar and higher grammar, which I call, and perhaps may be called in the future, we can't decide this yet, liturgical thinking. Liturgical thinking. Grammar or higher and higher grammar. So we have logic and concording. We have arithmetic and mathematics, or higher mathematics. We have grammar and liturgical thinking. In put in parentheses, higher grammar. Now, gentlemen, this course is an example in higher grammar. What you have learned is that a man is a child, an artist, he is a man and a fighter, and he is an elder. A priest. Now, gentlemen, in the first phase he is a thou, because his parents and his teachers and the world created him and allow him to play. He is entrusted to others. He listens. Now, I listen because you tell me to listen to me. Listen. He is thou. As a fighter he is I, and as a priest he is we. That's the grammar. And so my phrase is not wanton at all. Higher grammar takes man in his own declination, in his own conjugation, through the various persons. You are alternatingly thou and I. At this moment when you can't listen to me, you are thou, because you listen. I can feel your ear. If you give me an answer, or if you ask me a question, you become I. And in this freedom, our humanity rests. If he cannot alternate, if any one of you tries to be either thou, he remains childish, or I, he goes insane. In all the insane asylums, you find people who have lost the capacity of turning into we and thou. They all have a fixation that they always must say I. And therefore they no longer can adjust themselves to the way they appear to other people. So only to show you in a short way that higher grammar is as real as higher mathematics. If you look at all the life stories which I have given you, I'll try to show you that although John Quincy Adams was president, he still appeared to the other people as thou, a member of the Adams tribe, a child of the family. And only when he became congressman, you see, was he I, honest John Quincy. Before he thought he was I, but they didn't take him as it. He couldn't hear it. So, gentlemen, liturgy or higher grammar is the science of the future. And it will take 300 or 400 years to get it as highly developed as modern mathematics.
Excuse me, when you reach the we, one severe relationship between the process by which you reach that and the concording process that you can...
But let me embrace you. Certainly. Wonderful. All you see, I try to show you that it ends in one sentence, all the three times in our meeting connected. Just long enough to go into this, that you have understood it fully.
a scientist who says this is true, of course believes in God, because the truth is divine. So there is also a scholastic element in an academic subject. You can't get out of it. Any one statement I or whatever I told you is a question of your conscience, because you don't wish to lie. It's a question of your consciousness, because you say this is wrong. And it's a question of your self-consciousness, because if you are shy, you won't say it. So the power to make any statement always is the theological aspect, which is your relation with truth. The material aspect, which is the content of your sentence, which is a statement which you have before your consciousness. This is wrong. And your power to speak to the Lord to make the statement is a social power. It's a society. Everybody trusts you when you say it. Or he's outside. You don't have the power. So you see, in this one sentence, the chair is round, you are one third a theologian, one third a scientist, and one third a socialist.
By telling you that, by telling you that, or by writing, or by telling you, or by teaching, or by learning.
However, in the sentence, the chair is round, our interest is completely concentrated on the material aspect. We want this is called, you see, a statement of fact. So we are only interested in the fact. If you wish to have a sentence that is more clearly one-sided theologically, you will say, God does not exist. Because then you will provoke all the other people to praise God. Something will happen outside the realm of this chair, outside the realm of the attack. But if the chair is gone, has as much religion in it, if you think it is true, then anything only it is hidden. Most people think only that's a fact, that the chair is wrong. And they don't know that the speaker must believe this sentence to be true, or he must believe it is a lie. And he must also have the courage to say it.
Gentlemen, now comes
My time is up. Sorry. So next time, I wish to develop a little further the relation of logic, mathematics, and grammar.